Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ms. Meek. Mr. Haler and Ms. Keebler have three claims in this lawsuit. One is a common law restraint of trade claim. Actually, there's four if you count the statutory restraint of trade claim. And then there's an intentional interference claim against RBC Bank or mortgage company, and a RESA claim against Bank One. The restraint of trade claim is based upon the simple fact that the two banks entered into a contract that required Bank One to fire the plaintiffs and not hire them for a period of 6 months. It seems to me that this pretty much meets the definition of a contract that restrains trade, and that trade in this case is the plaintiff's ability to seek employment opportunities with their long-term employer, Bank One. The intentional interference claim is based upon the same theory, because when you analyze these claims, there's all these factors you look at to see if there's a justification. One of them is the social interest of the plaintiffs, and the plaintiffs have a strong social interest in not being subjected to a contract that, in essence, was a private form of a discredited tort remedy called harboring a servant, which the South Carolina Supreme Court declared unconstitutional in 1920. The ERISA claim is based upon the fact that...
Do you have any authority after 1920 or in any federal court?
No, I don't, Your Honor. And it is...
I wonder what, on your view, would happen if the Lyric Opera said, as it actually did say, to Luciano Pavarotti, "We're never going to hire you again." Would that be tortious, unconstitutional?
Let me make sure I understand your question. The an opera company said to him...
Yeah, they fired Luciano Pavarotti for being unreliable and said, in public,
right,
"Never darken our door again. We will never engage you. Your field of action is limited to the entire rest of the world." Now, as I understand your argument, that would violate the 13th Amendment. One employer saying, "We will never employ X again."
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor.
Then I don't understand your argument here at all, because all J.P. Morgan said is, "We won't hire you for 6 months."
That's true, but they said it in concert with another employer. You see, it's...
Suppose the Lyric.
The law...
With the Met about this.
The law of conspiracy is clear that two people can often not do things that one person by himself could do. And, of course, Bank One had no obligation to these individuals per se.
On your view, the NBA draft is a violation of the 13th Amendment, because the 30 teams agree that only 29 of them will drop out and only one person will try to hire a basketball player. Pretty extraordinary argument.
Well, as a matter of fact, that's pretty much what happened in that South Carolina case. And
yeah, that's why I ask you, since there are an awful lot of things like the NBA draft that go on open and above board for a very long time without anybody thinking that they are violations of the antitrust laws or of the 13th Amendment or anything like that.
Well, I think it's a little bit of a stretch to compare my clients to NBA players who get drafted and make enormous amounts of money and are able to enter into an employment contract that's very lucrative, and perhaps it can be sold and bartered. These are just individuals out here. They had a job with a long-term employer, and then all of a sudden that employer agrees to sell them. I just don't think that's right, Your Honor. And this contract, on the face of it, did restrain their right to trade. No matter how we compare it with anything else, that's a plain fact. The ERISA claim is based upon the fact that the Bank One basically was confronted with three choices when it got out of this particular business. One was to do what it had always done and take the employees and employ them somewhere else in the bank, in which case there would have been no lawsuit. Two was to pay them a severance benefit. Three was to come up with this scheme whereby they could avoid the severance benefit and sell the employees to boot. So they not only got rid of their severance agreement, But they got this nice contract with this compliant second bank to make some money. And it seems to me that this meets all the requirements of Andy's case about ERISA violation in discharges like this. The law of restraint and trade, or restraint of trade in Indiana, has never been modified. The statutory restraint of trade theory that was law that was adopted in 1907 did not articulate any preemption sorts of defenses. The Sherman Antitrust Act also has no such preemption defenses. As far as it looks to me, I'm entitled to rely on an 1894 Indiana case about restraint of trade, which was also used in a later case, 1950s. Simply put, the contract here restrained the rights of the plaintiff to seek employment with their long-term employer for a period of 6 months. They were told they were being sold to this employer. There was coercion put on them to go to work for this employer, which, of course, they didn't do. But that was the intent of the two employers, that they would do that. So it appears to me when you put all this together, you've got two valid tort claims that shouldn't have been dismissed. In fact, probably the plaintiff should have gotten summary judgment. glad to answer any of your questions. I think I saved a little time for rebuttal.
Your clients were at-will employees of Bank One, is that right?
Excuse me?
Your clients were, up until their termination, at-will employees.
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Kimball.
Thank you.
Ms. Meek.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dustin Meek. I'm here on behalf of Defendant Appellees, J.P. Morgan Chase, formerly Bank One, RBC Mortgage Company. It is undisputed that Bank One wanted to discontinue its brokered real estate lending business in order to focus more company resources and efforts on more profitable direct loan products and services. Record evidence supports this fact. There is no evidence controverting it. It is also undisputed that my client, RBC, wanted to expand its wholesale lending capabilities and obtain Bank One's business assets, goodwill, and market territories exhibited by the current Bank One employees. The sale transaction was entered into at the end of May 2003 between these companies for, as is undisputed, legitimate business considerations. Appellants' ERISA benefits at issue here are severance benefits. We are not talking about vested pension benefits. These severance benefits are benefits that can be changed, modified, and even terminated at the sole discretion of Bank One, the employer, and that is supported by case law consistently. RBC met the definition in the plan at issue for a successor employee. The appellants do not present challenge on appeal to Bank One's plan administrator's determination that benefits could not be received by these particular employees. Appellants were offered jobs by RBC to which they declined and found jobs in their professional line of work approximately 63 days following the effective date of the sale between my clients. There is no allegation in this appeal that the appellants were forced to work at any particular location. Instead, they complained that they were prevented from working at the single one location or company at which they wanted to work. Their challenge here is a challenge to choice. Their challenge here is a challenge to choice of one. Neither appellant applied for a position at Bank One following the effective date of the sale of June 15, 2003, and indeed following the 180-day limitation period as expressed in the asset purchase agreement, neither of the plaintiff appellants sought to reapply at a company that they say they so wish to continue to work. I disagree with something that plaintiffs said. Well, I disagree with many things that plaintiffs' appellants' counsel said in his argument, but one I want to bring to the panel's attention. The contract here between my clients, contrary to as stated by counsel, did not require Bank One to fire Ms. Deisch-Keebler and Mr. Haler. Instead, the contract said that Bank One was exiting the business. They no longer wish to do this type of work. The consideration here wasn't that Bank One fire employees. The consideration here was that Bank One agreed not to hire or solicit them for employment for a limited period of time, 180 days. I do agree with plaintiff's statement in his presentation that this contract does restrain the plaintiffs. But as we have provided in our briefs and is supported by ample case law in federal circuits, district courts, and even state Supreme Courts, this is a lawful restraint. Not every restraint is illegal or improper. Commercial realities dictate that some restraints are proper and, in fact, justified. This is one of those proper, justified restraints of trade. It is limited in time. It is limited in scope. It has no anti-competitive effect on competition. And the only result is that which I have previously stated. Plaintiffs were prevented of their choice of an employer for a period of 180 days. There is no evidence in this record at all of any malintent by either of my clients. There is no evidence in this record of coercion. There is no evidence in this record of anything other than my clients trying to provide an opportunity for these two employees of Bank One to determine whether they wanted to continue in their line of work, doing the business they had known to be doing for several years prior, albeit with a different company. My clients organized meetings here in Chicago at the Palmer House. They made representatives from both companies available to answer questions. They circulated Q&As via email. And granted, these particular employees were upset about losing their jobs at Bank One, and they valued those jobs. But this restraint and the reality of this agreement between my companies is not improper. Likewise, on their ERISA claim, as the Andes Court makes claim, and I will raise that since appellant's counsel raised that decision, the D.C. Circuit looked at a challenge under Section 510 of ERISA and considered whether in a sale of business situation you could present a Section 510 challenge. The court recognized through looking at congressional history that Section 510 really wasn't promulgated for the purpose of dealing with sale of businesses or lines of businesses, but rather it was there to prevent focused, intentional conduct of an employee toward individuals. Nonetheless, the D.C. Circuit did not create a clear line ruling and instead said, we are going to look at and see whether there's specific intent. And again, in this case, there is no specific intent of discrimination or any effort to harm these particular employees. For the reasons as stated in our briefs and for the reasons as stated in my oral argument here today, We respectfully request that the Seventh Circuit affirm in all respects Judge Sarah Barker's ruling in the court below. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Meek. Anything further, Mr. Kimball?
Yes, Your Honor. Ms. Meek admitted that the contract restrained the rights of my clients to trade, and the case that she relied on in her brief was a covenant not to compete case. And the problem with that analogy is my clients never agreed to anything. In covenant not to compete cases, you've got two parties that agree to something, and one of them is unhappy, and litigation ensues. And that gets back to Your Honor's remark about the draft. I believe when basketball players enter the draft, they contract to give up their right to do what you said and be bound to one team, the team that drafts them. And, of course, when people agree to things, it's a lot different than when they don't agree to things. I also have to take issue.
Contracts or not, after they're drafted, they don't agree to something that says that they can negotiate with only one team. That's done unilaterally by the league.
Well, I can't imagine why a player would want to complain after entering into a lucrative contract with the team. However, if he did...
Ask Kurt Flood whether you can imagine people wanting to complain.
If he did, he can't be...
Kurt Flood did complain.
He can't be forced to work...
in the Supreme Court.
He can't be forced to work.
If you want to talk about Flood, for example, right? If you want to talk about the actual case law, I would be interested to see how your case could be distinguished from Flood, for example.
If a player doesn't want to work for a team he has a contract with, he can't be forced to work for it. Now, he can be sued, but he can't be forced to work for it. Ms. Keebler begged for a job with Bank One. She did not formally apply because she was told she couldn't apply. She'd been sold to the other bank. If you don't have any questions, I'll sit down and be quiet.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.
Mm-hmm.